Good evening, one and all. Yes, we made another middle of the week. It's Wednesday, and this is me, Barry, with another book and a chat. Well, one of the things when you sort of people go to be authors, you know, quite often you start on a small scale, writing little short stories, perhaps, you know, doing stuff for a paper, reviews, that sort of thing. And in fact, I remember going to a school and doing a talk on sort of my book and the writing and that, and the people were saying, well, how do you start writing? Well, you sort of, I said to them, well, you know, who writes a diary? And some wrote a diary. I said, well, who sort of texts? And of course, they all say text. Well, that's a start. And then a couple of them had blogs and that, and that's how it goes. You go through that. Well, the next thing is, okay, so now I've got it. What am I going to do for the subject? And sometimes the stories come to you. Sometimes you'd like a different genre. And if you like a genre, then you say, well, what might not have been done before? What's something different? What's there a twist that I can bring into it? Well, my guest today, I think he's got something totally unique. Well, it doesn't ring a bell with me in anyway. But I'd better introduce him, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only James L. May. Hi, James. How are you doing?
Hi, Barry. I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. As I said, I mean, you obviously sort of studied English and stuff like that. But and then after that, I guess you did sort of short fiction and that. Is that right?
Well, some, yeah. Of course, what has come out now is a novel, but I did a Master of Fine Arts in writing at Florida International University in Miami, and so yeah, writing short fiction was certainly part of that curriculum.
I mean, you know, as you said, you've now sort of produced your first book, and it's a thriller. Is that the sort of genre that you liked, or is it just the one you decided to sort of try out first off?
Oh no, it's very much. Well, I like many genres, but I love a good thriller. And in fact, it's a murder mystery, yeah. And that's a genre that I've been, just reading in. Well, I think for all of my adult life, I think I resisted mysteries when I was a kid. I think I thought of them as, my parents really liked them,
yes.
I thought of them as grown-up books.
Yes.
But, you know, once I became a grown-up, I duly started reading mysteries. And, so it's certainly it's a genre I've loved for a long time.
Well, in your debut book, The Body Outside the Kremlin, as it sort of sounds, it's not from the normal sort, is it? It's actually in Russia. But not just in Russia, the bloke's in a really bad sort of prison camp, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he sure is. Yeah, so he's in a prison camp that was called, it's known as the Solovetsky Camp, which was operated in the 1920s and some ways into the 30s. And it was set, you often think of Russian prison camps as being in Siberia,
yeah.
So that's way in the northeast of Russia. But this one's actually in the northwest. It's in the White Sea. And it's on this set of islands called the Solovetsky Islands. So that's where the camp gets its name from.
Ah.
And what has just been endlessly fascinating to me about this place, I mean, you know, I've been writing about it for a long time, and I still think it's great. Well, it's not, I shouldn't say great. Some really horrible stuff happened there, but it is interesting. I don't get tired of reading about it.
Yeah,
Well, the interesting piece is that go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, I mean, even the White Sea, it's not something you hear of all the time. You know, people know about the Black Sea, the Dead Sea, the Caspian Sea, but the White Sea, again, is just not a place you hear about.
Oh, no, that's right, yeah. Oh, I mean, it's remote. It's not very well settled. I think the closest city of any size is Arkhangelsk, which is about 250 miles away, something like that. So, and, I mean, in its way, it's a beautiful place, but it's not a place that there's a lot going on.
Right.
So, you know, that's why you might not have heard about it. But what was there for about 500 years before it became a prison camp was a Russian Orthodox monastery.
Ah, right.
And, yeah. So that's, and, you know, this place had its own whole religious history. It was well known. It was one of certainly the largest in the Russian north. And it was kind of, in some ways, it was a sort of symbol of remoteness and serenity and, you know, religious devotion in Russia. And then, you know, when the communists came to power in 1917, and duly they won the Russian Civil War and needed a place to send, you know, the people that they wanted to repress, they took this place over from the church. And they thought, well, it's remote, it's isolated, people can't get to or from it easily. Why don't we set up this prison camp? And yeah, they're just what what comes from that is just this sort of series of, you know, paradoxes and contradictions that's just been fascinating all along.
Because being, you know, such an isolated place, as you say, I mean, it, ideal for that sort of thing. I mean, apart from the poor people who have to work there, not just the prisoners, the people who have to work there, you know, there's not exactly a lot for them. But nobody, even if you escape, you're not exactly going to get far from there, I'd have thought.
No, you're not. And in fact, there were escapes from this camp. I mean, in, you know, real, it really happened historically. So it was four prisoners who escaped. They didn't actually escape from the island. They escaped from a camp where they were being held before transport to the island. Uh-huh. But they had to get all the way to Finland, which is the closest international border. Yeah. And they had to trek hundreds of miles through the forest in winter in order to really escape from the place. It was grueling.
Right, I can imagine. Now, your hero, Tolya Bogomolov.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that was close.
Yeah, well done.
Okay, now, I mean, he's there for, what, just a three-year sentence or something? Is he, it's not a sort of life-type sentence.
Well, no, it's not a lifetime sentence. Generally, at that stage of the history of the Russian or the Soviet prison system, prisoners were sent away for either 3, 5, or 10 years. And so Tolya's gotten the shortest sentence he was likely to get. But it was, I mean, number one, a three-year sentence, it was a very deadly place. So 3 years, that might very well be the rest of your life.
Right, yeah.
And even if you survived, the Soviet Union was regimented enough. It kept a lot of track of its citizens with what were known as internal passports that said where you could and couldn't go. So, even if you were released from a prison like this, you weren't able to resume normal life. You were still prohibited from going to certain cities, and they more or less continued to control your life. You just didn't have to stay in that particular prison.
Right. And obviously, one of the things, as you mentioned, was the fact it used to be a monastery. And that's one of the things that comes up, isn't it? That trying to sort of basically sort out the icons that they seized.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So I mentioned that the Solovetsky Monastery had been the largest in the Russian Northwest. Well, probably the largest in the Russian North. And so the monks had been there. It was a large monastery, quite wealthy. It supported itself on land grants, and the monks did various kinds of work. And so they had amassed this collection of, you know, what you would really call sort of treasures. So icons are the most important piece for my book, and in some ways that was, I think, the largest part of the collection. But other stuff too, you know, sort of golden icon covers, so it's called an iconostasis, which in the Russian Orthodox Church is a big sort of screen that stands before the altar, which is typically beautifully decorated and lavishly decorated. You know, these are made of at least gold and silver plated. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so the Soviet secret police, having started this prison in this old monastery, the question was, what are we going to do with this stuff? And you would think, well, you know, they'd sell it, they'd destroy it. They were resolutely anti-religious. Mm-hmm. But what they did instead was create of what was called the museum, and it was a collection of the monks' things and some other things that the prison collected. That was in fact administered by the prisoners. Which it's a strange, it's a strange thing to do. I mean, it's really quite weird. I think, you know, the prison, in some ways, they were sort of still trying to work out what a prison would be under the new communist regime, and of course. A big part of what it was from the very beginning was really harsh and deadly labor, but they also had them do, you know, some cultural work too, like the museum. There was a theater that was very popular and active in the Solovetsky prison. And some of those things did exist in later camps, but it was much, much less common than it was on Solovetsky. So yeah, one of the interesting things about the place is that they're sort of, as I said, discovering what they might want, the prison to be, and some of that really does take shape from the monks, from the monastery place that it's set in.
And that's strange, you know, because you tend to think, okay, these people are in this harsh prison, and yet they're sort of doing some work that you would think just wasn't prisoners type work.
Yeah, well, you are, and that's, you know, it's very strange to have that kind of thing existing alongside what really was. I mean, I shouldn't understate the harshness and deadliness of this prison. You know, I mean, people starved, they died of, you know, disease was very deadly in the prison. Prisoners are all sleeping together in one room, and you know, they don't get to change their clothes. So typhus, which is spread by lice, was very, very deadly. But so one of the strategies, in fact, for getting out of this sort of harsh and deadly labor was to try to get one of these more, you know, what you'd call a desk job, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you can do it sitting down. It's a lot easier. So, you know, that's in fact, you see that throughout the history of the Gulag. Prisoners are always trying to, the work is so deadly that almost the only strategy they have is to try to do something else. But yeah, it was often the case that was cultural work on Selvetsky. And in fact, that's the, My character, Tolia, as the book opens, that's what he's been trying to do. He's been trying to get to know someone who works in the museum.
Okay, so that sort of desk job.
Yeah, thinking that they can get him a position there, and that that'll make his life a little bit easier.
The prison itself, I mean, is that just, like, I don't know, blue collar, or has it got the full diversity across, you know, perhaps some priests and stuff like that there?
Oh, yeah, well, it's got a fairly good cross-section of Russian society. In fact, I don't know, I have not seen statistics on this, but I think probably that the educated classes, what they at the time would have called the intelligentsia,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where our word intelligentsia comes from,
yeah.
That started in Russian. They were probably a little bit better represented in the prison than other classes of people. Number one, because of course, you know, the new communist state was ostensibly at least a state for the workers. So, you know, they were trying not to imprison workers, although they certainly did. I mean, they mistreated workers along with everybody else. But also because the intelligentsia had, you know, they had ideas, they argued back and forth, they had, you know, their own politics. They were more likely to get into arguments with the new regime. And what the regime did was send them off to prison. So a lot of them did find themselves there.
Okay. Now, obviously, he's looking for this desk job, but it doesn't happen. He ends up right in left field, sort of looking at, you know, trying to working with the detective to sort of try and work out a murder, which seems very strange to sort of get pushed into that.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's I mentioned that he's been sort of cultivating this friend in the museum. Unfortunately for him, the friend ends up dead. And so he first gets involved because, you know, the camp somehow, or the camp administrators somehow know that about this friendship. And so they're sort of questioning him about it. And then the investigator that the camp administrators bring in is also a prisoner. I should pause and say, almost all of the work of administering the camp was done by prisoners themselves. For a camp of, you know, in 1926, it was like 10,000 prisoners.
Wow.
There were only, you know, 50 to 80 actual guards who were employed to work there. Everybody else was prison labor, and, you know, there was a hierarchy among the prisoners. So it's obviously odd for them to bring in a prisoner investigator, but it's not quite as odd as it might sound.
Right, yeah, I guess so, yeah. Now,
so the man they bring in is an old man, he needs help, you know, just getting around the island and, you know, picking stuff up and turning it over to look for clues. So that's how Tolia gets involved.
Okay, because the thing, if I remember right, isn't it that this is, like, written umpteen years later on, and it's Tolia's actually looking back on what happened?
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, so it's written, Tolia is looking back from 1956, what happened to him in 1926. And 1956 is actually a pretty important date. That's after Stalin had died and Khrushchev, who was the premier of the Soviet Union following Stalin, was taking over. And he was sort of repudiating a lot of the really, you know, terrible totalitarian terror that Stalin had instituted. I mean, repudiating to a certain degree. So that was a period known as the thaw. So things were getting more liberal. You know, there was the thought that maybe we'll be able to talk more freely about what's happened. Eventually that was cracked down upon. But during that period, what was known as samizdat literature sort of started to be circulated. The samizdat means self-publishing. So
okay.
People began, they began writing things and reproducing them on carbon paper. They didn't have copy machines at that time. So, you know, sometimes just typing them out over and over again and circulating them among them, you know, just from person to person. Because, of course, you couldn't publish anything that was critical of the regime or that described the camps, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Tolia doesn't actually know that he's involved in samizdat, but as it emerges, as the book goes on, that's kind of where his writing is destined to be circulated.
And I guess, you know, doing it like that enables you to sort of almost correct yourself, you know, when you've got the planner story, to add some more twists than that to it, because, you know, the flexibility of hindsight, shall I say, you know, it must give you sort of quite a few more ways you can sort of twist the story around.
Yeah, well, it does. I think the thing that I was most interested in sort of that retrospective telling of the story is, you know, it lets you see what the effect on these characters is on the one character who's telling the story, the effect of the story on his later life. I mentioned already that, you know, once you'd served your sentence in the gulag, you know, your punishment wasn't over. Your life was still sort of made terrible by the regime. So I did want to make sure that was represented for Tolia. And I think people who did survive the camps, they often experienced, you know, what we would now call survivor's guilt. They found themselves really, you know, sort of feeling emotionally dead in many reports, and feeling like, you know, there was no reason for me to survive when so many died around me. And so I was interested in that too. And so Tolia sort of writing from the future, or from the present about the past, however you
right.
used to.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. The Body Outside the Kremlin, as I said, debut book. One of the things that's come up often in the past is, especially sort of these days, that we've come across people who've, you know, done the hard work. I've written a book, it's got published. And I always say, no, that's when the hard work starts. Did you find that?
No, you mean after publication?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yes, yeah. I mean, the question of how to promote the book is a difficult one. I mean, I think, you know, everyone struggles with that. There's people have their ideas about how to use Twitter and how to use Facebook and so forth. It just came out 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So what I've done so far, I've certainly enjoyed interviews like this one and, you know, a couple of writing projects in various online magazines. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I certainly don't feel like I've mastered it at all.
No, I remember sort of I think I was doing a talk on about promoting your book. And, you know, this person came up and he'd given his job up, you know, because he thought that this was going to be the, you know, the next big huge hit and everything like that. And he was under the impression that he just sat back, you know, the hard work's done.
Yeah.
But no, that's especially these days. To me, the hard work starts at that point because, as you say, you've got to promote it. You've got to get it out there. If people don't know about it, then they're not going to be able to read it, sort of thing.
Yeah, of course. Although, you know, I'm sympathetic with the guy who approached you, though, because, of course, it is a huge amount of hard work to write the book and get it out. And you sort of feel, I think, you know, many writers, not all, but many writers, they'd sort of, the kind of hard work they want to do is the hard work at their desk. And then when you ask them to go out and, you know, promote themselves and talk to 1,000 people about the book, that's, you know, daunting. Whoa, I didn't sign up for that. So I feel that way a little bit, but I'm trying to. I know that that's must be overcome.
Right, indeed. I mean, as you said, it's only been out a couple of weeks. What's the response been like so far?
Well, there have been a number of rather good reviews that have run. So that's certainly been quite heartening. I think the people I've talked to about it in interviews and at the reading we did, certainly people have been asking great questions about the history of the place. And, you know, I really do, I hope the story stands on its own as well, but I really do think that Solovetsky deserves to be better known. So yeah, it's been really gratifying to have people ask about it and learn about it.
And that's one of the things I love about doing these shows is that, you know, I learn all the time. Like talking to you about the location and stuff like that. And you never stop learning, which is great. Are you thinking of what are you thinking about for a follow-up?
Well, it's a good question. I think at least for the immediate future, I don't think there's another this is probably not a series book. Mm-hmm. I think I've sort of written Tolia into a corner. I won't give away exactly how, but I did cover 30 years of his life with the retrospective thing. Yeah. That wouldn't be impossible to get around. But I think I'm ready for a break. My wife sort of jokes that, like, you know, the book is finally published. We can escape from Solovetsky. There is something a little oppressive about writing about a prison camp for years and years. The short thing I'm presently working on is a ghost story, which is a new genre and interesting to me. It's interesting to learn about. I like writing in choosing a new genre. I like sort of learning the new rules of a new kind of writing. So
I think that's good. You dip your toes in lots of water and see which one you feel happier with. I think that's a great way of doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
The actual area itself, you know, as you've been telling us, you know, it's pretty well, you know, stuff you sort of really known about and stuff like that. Has it surprised you how few people know about that whole area?
Well, I think it has. I mean, it's interesting. The history of the Gulag is certainly not widely known in the United States. Mm. I think the Gulag, in some ways, there are such enormities, there's no comparison. You know, the Gulag is often compared to the Nazi death camps of World War II, which, you know, the Gulag was not a death camp in the sense that people weren't exterminated there, but they certainly were worked to death in huge, huge numbers, comparable to the Nazi camps. Yeah. And I think, so, you know, people certainly know the Nazi concentration camps in the U.S. a lot better than they do the Gulag ones. And that's partly because the Soviet Union hid it for a long time from the international community. I mean, have I been surprised? I mean, I wouldn't say I'm surprised about that because, you know, I don't think I certainly knew much less when I began reading and writing about this than I do now. In some ways, the thing that has surprised me that, you know, comparing it to the state of things in the United States is the degree to which people don't know about our own prison system. What's striking to me learning about this is, well, there was a controversy, well, not a controversy, but sort of a certain amount of conversation on a few Russia-oriented blogs in about 2014 about someone had made the claim that the incarceration rate in the United States now was about the same as it had been in the Gulag in the 30s. And that, which, I mean, you know, really brought me up short because the Gulag was, you know, just such a, it was a tremendous incarceration. Yeah. People were being hauled off left and right.
Yeah.
I think that the consensus, you know, the best account I can say does say that the U.S. incarceration rate isn't actually quite as high as the Gulag rate. And of course, the U.S. prisons are nowhere near as deadly as the Gulag prisons were.
Right.
But it is kind of comparable. You know, in the U.S., we imprison, you know, it's in the area of about 800 people per 100,000 people, so almost 1%. And then in the Gulag, they imprisoned about, you know, 2,000 people per 100,000 people. So it's, you know, 2%. So we're only, you know, we are kind of in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
That's certainly not something I knew before I began reading about the Gulag. And I think people generally ought to know more about how prisons work.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have thought, you know, the Gulag was a lot higher than the U.S. today because of just the percentage of people, etc. But obviously not.
Yeah. I mean, it's higher, but it's not a lot higher.
No,
yeah,
not
I mean,
a lot. Not like you'd think it was. There was, I think there was, and I'm racking my brains here, that might have been 15, 20 years ago. And I think it was in, I want to say the sort of previously Russian owned part of Czechoslovakia or something like that. They found a great big mass grave from one of these places, and I can't think what it was, but I think that's where I first heard and sort of learned about these.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those things certainly were you know, they were covered up at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things that made them sort of work as a technique of repression was, you know, you sort of never knew what was really true and how bad it was. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. people knew it was very bad, but the sense that people could just be taken off and disappear was part of what yeah. made it, you know, made it terrifying to live under a regime like that. So that's, you know, that was, I think the fact that we don't know is sort of part of the program in a way.
Yeah, it's like the fear in you know, in the Second World War for the German people who sort of you know, being sent to the Russian front. It's the fear that sort of keeps them under control almost.
Well, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, it's because you know, I mean, the question, the Russian front was terribly, terribly deadly for both sides.
And yeah.
Yeah, one of the you know, why, you know, if you're, if it's almost a death sentence to be sent to the front, why go? And
yeah.
the answer is, you know, what's going to happen to you if you stay behind?
Exactly.
That was true, actually, for the Russians, too.
Yeah.
One of the many people were sent to the Gulag, not even because they had done anything. They were often sent off as traitors just because they had been trapped behind enemy lines for a while. And the thinking was, well, we don't know if they're spies. They might be because they survived behind enemy lines. So,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
we may as well imprison them. It's a rather cruel piece of thinking there.
That's indeed. Well, James, time has whizzed by, as it always does when we're having such an enjoyable chat. But so what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, well, they can look at my website, which is just James, my name, jameselmay.com, which has information about the book and where it's available. It can be purchased at your local bookstore. If they aren't carrying it, they can certainly order it for you. And it's available on Amazon and any kind of online bookseller as well. And if they are really interested in finding out more about the book and about me, they can look at my publisher's website, which is Delphinium Books. And that has not only more info about the book, but they actually do little Q&As with all of their authors.
Oh,
so
right.
So if you're interested in that, I can't remember what they asked, but, you know, it's things like my favorite movie and so forth.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know why that should interest anyone too much, but if you want to learn that, you certainly can. So.
Well, James, it's been great chatting to you. Thanks so much for being on the show. And perhaps when your next one comes out, perhaps if your ghost book comes out, you come back and chat to us again.
Yeah, I hope to. It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there you go. Our guest today, great, talking about his book, James L. May. James L., letter L., May. And we've been talking about his debut novel, great thriller, some great reviews there, called The Body Outside the Kremlin. Really interesting. I think it's one of these ones with so many twists and stuff like that. Plus, as we've been hearing on the show, the amount of stuff we learn about it as we go through it as well, which I think is always a big plus. Well, that's it. I will be back on Sunday with my music shows. Those were the days, which is, we're just finishing off our Round the World in 80 Songs. Well, it's about 150 so far, but we're on the homeward stretch. We're just travelling back from America back to where we started in England. So this will be the last one of those shows, and that's on Sunday, isn't it? Sunday, of course, between 5 and 6 p.m. Eastern. And then at 6:30, as always, at 6:30 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, we have the British Invasion, 30 non-stop minutes of music that invaded America in the 60s and 70s. Well, that's that. And, of course, I will be back next Tuesday here with a book and a chat and another guest. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget.